This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from the Eternal City, the City of Seven Hills, Rome, Italy, or to be more precise, Vatican City. But enough of that. I'm gonna get to that tomorrow. Tomorrow, I will be in audience with Pope Francis as he consecrates Russia and the Ukraine to Mary, the Blessed Virgin Mary, Sacred Heart of Mary. I will be there for that, and I will be reporting on that and much, much more. But today, I'm doing a very special show, and the reason I'm doing today's show now is because I don't want people to think, especially I don't want the Afghan community to think that with what's happening in Ukraine, we have forgotten about them. If you think I have forgotten about Afghanistan, you forget. You forgot. I don't forget. We don't stop. And in fact, most of my day-to-day activities, most of my day from when the moment I open my eyes till the moment I close my eyes, it's focused on Afghanistan. We have a team in Ukraine. I will be going there. We're evacuating people in the thousands. We have a medical team as well. We're doing a lot of work there. But we are doing more work. We are more engaged in Afghanistan simply because there's not a lot of help and no one's paying attention. And more people are going to die this winter in Afghanistan sorrowfully than in Ukraine because of famine and because of exposure. And we have been doing our best to limit those casualties, but we're just one small organization in the midst of a sea of suffering. So today, this show from Rome, I'm going to be interviewing the great Prince Wafa in San Diego. And you've never met a guy like Prince Wafa. You need to listen to this entire interview and then share it with all of your friends. But I'm just going to set it up. Prince Wafa runs the Vulnerable People Project's ground operations in Afghanistan. What does that mean? That he is in charge of all of our operations to evacuate and to rescue people that are facing imminent death. Also, he has one of our largest food delivery operations. He can get food pretty much anywhere in Afghanistan within 24 hours, most places within four. But how did I get to know Prince Wafa? How did he become a part of our team? His friend saw me on EWTN in late August. And then we got in touch with Prince while he was still, as an American citizen, in Afghanistan, stuck. Why was he stuck there? Because he snuck into Afghanistan. You're going to have to hear the whole story. He snuck into Afghanistan in July as Afghanistan was beginning to fall. Why would an American citizen who was wanted by the Taliban sneak into Afghanistan? Well, it was to rescue his wife. You see, he's an Afghan who earned his citizenship through a special immigration visa status because of his service. He came to the United States with not a penny in his pocket, started working as a cashier at a 7-Eleven on the night shift, and in a few years became the owner of that 7-Eleven. A few years of a lot of hard work, working two jobs, three jobs, working every waking hour while going to school. And then he was dreaming of bought a beautiful home, had his own business, and was dreaming of bringing his bride to the United States. And they went through all of the processes properly. And when Afghanistan began to collapse, he was not going to leave her there. So he snuck into the country, was stuck there. His friend saw me on EWTN. That's how we got contacted. And you'll just have to listen to the rest of the story. And you've never met a man like him. This episode is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project. Go to thegreatcampaign.org. And when you become a donor over there at thegreatcampaign.org, you're a part of our team, standing between the vulnerable and the violent, standing with the most vulnerable people in the world, standing with Prince Wafa and the rest of our team. So go to thegreatcampaign.org, become a donor. Also, as always, this episode is being brought to you by Mike Lindell and MyPillow. So go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, and get deep discounts. Now listen, I'm a little tongue-tied, but I'm in Rome. I'm here for a lot of meetings with large aid organizations, different governments. I'll be traveling around Europe. We're working on getting visas for Afghan refugees, but I'll be going to Poland and beyond, meeting with our teams, rescuing, running caravans from Ukraine to Poland, and also meeting with our medical teams. So I'll be doing that as well. I'm carrying around this podcast equipment. I'll hope to do some podcasts, but the work can be emotionally exhausting. I can't promise you I'm going to be in the mood for podcasts after in the coming days, but I'm going to do my best. But I will definitely come in the next couple days to talk about what we're doing here in Rome before I go to Poland. We'll definitely be doing that. But the reason why we're interviewing Prince Wafa on our work in Afghanistan is we cannot forget about the plight of our friends, those who were made vulnerable because they served alongside the United States or they worked for Western aid organizations. We have abandoned countless tens of thousands of Afghans, many of them hiding still from the Taliban. We're supporting them and we're in contact with them. Many others are stuck in what are called lily pads, waiting to be resettled, but they're not hearing a peep from the U.S. State Department. We promised them from the beginning that we will be with them until they're safe and until they're permanently resettled. And as an organization, that doesn't mean there won't be flare-ups. We used the Beijing Genocide Olympics to bring attention to the plight of the Uyghur. We responded to requests for help in Ukraine, and we're doing our best there. But we are with the people of Afghanistan, and we are with all of our friends that have been made vulnerable by our foreign policy catastrophe there. And we will be with them until they are safely resettled. And why so many of them are safe are because of this great man, Prince Wafa, who you now are privileged to meet. All right, here we go. Prince Wafa on the Jason Jones Show. Prince Wafa, welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me here.
I can't believe it's taken me this long to get you on the show.
Well, you know, like running around, keeping busy with the stuff in Afghanistan. I didn't know I could be that busy as well, but it's like a 24/7 thing right now. It's nonstop.
Well, that's why I wanted to have you on the show, because I want our audience to know, and so many people listening to the show, you know, are folks we're helping in Afghanistan, people we've helped who are now in Pakistan or in UAE, and they listen to this show. And we've been
awesome. We'll be definitely happier to have them in the U.S. and final destination. We're doing anything we can every day, nonstop, 24/7, to help people in Afghanistan, the ones we helped to go to Pakistan or UAE. But we're not stop fighting until everybody is settled at the final destination.
And that's why I want you on the show, Prince. Now, I'm in Rome right now. And I'm here primarily for Ukraine, but I'm also here. I have an opportunity to meet with very large aid organizations and also different countries' diplomats. And I'll also be going to Germany later next week, hopefully, to find ways to get visas for migrants, you know, refugees that we're working with that are now in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other countries waiting for permanent resettlement. But we've been so focused on Ukraine. Well, it seems like we've been so focused on Ukraine, though. As an organization, most of our work has been every day. Most of our day-to-day work, most of our funding is still going to help in Afghanistan. We have medical teams in Ukraine. We're funding evacuations in Ukraine. And one of our vans was shelled by Russia, which got a lot of media. And so I got inundated with emails from the Afghan community saying, hey, you haven't forgotten about us. So now that I'm in Rome, it was just important to me that I got you on the air. So, A, I wanted to introduce you to our audience because you're an exceptional man. You're a hero. You're an American hero, but you're also an Afghan hero. I want people to know you. And then after...
Thank you so much for all the hard work, Jason. Sorry, I cut you off, I guess.
No, I'm sorry. And after, I think it's the delay, but after I want to talk about your story, and then maybe we can move into what we're doing every day to help those who helped us in Afghanistan. Prince, but how did you... I want you to share with the audience how you and I got to know each other.
Well, when things were basically all, you know, out of control in Afghanistan, when I was in Afghanistan, basically desperately asking for help anywhere, I reached out to some of my military friend that we used to serve together in Afghanistan, and one of them was Jared Windup, a colonel in National Guard, like at the moment. I reached out to him like, hey, colonel, I'm stuck in Afghanistan. So he was shocked, like, what are you doing there? I was like, okay, I went there to bring my wife home, but I got stuck here. So he's one of the audience of National Catholic News Agency, TV, I believe, something like that name, yeah.
It was, yeah, he was watching EWTN, Global Catholic EWTN. Television. Yeah.
Yes. So he saw you there on one of the interview, and then he contacted me, was like, hey, Prince, I found, like, he was like, I've been trying contacting everyone, but I found this gentleman, like, I just saw him on the news. I will just give it a shot. Like, he was like, I don't know how much chance we have here too, but I'll just give it a shot, because he was tired of, like, you know, contacting government agencies, you know, like local agencies, anyone he knew that could be helpful, he contacted. But he was like, well, I don't know how much he will be helpful, but let me just give it a shot, you know? Like, and then he sent in a suggestion email, including me, you, I believe. Yeah, we were like three of us, and say like, hey, you know, introduce me to you, Jason. And that's how we got connected. So we're not believing that we got in touch like within a few hours. And it was a time that I was totally out of money. And then Jason somehow managed to send me some cash in Afghanistan. I was like, I wasn't broke, but I was out of the money because there was no banking system going in Afghanistan. There was like no money transfer. I wasn't expecting to be there for a couple of months. I was only supposed to be a couple of weeks or a couple of days. But yeah, that's how we got connected. And then through the journey in Afghanistan to Qatar to US, we were nonstop in touch, contacting each other. And thank you for all the support you did during that journey. And that made me think of like, well, if someone without even knowing you can do this much for you to help, why you're not stepping in and you know, be a shoulder for him to help your own people in Afghanistan and the people who we have promised as a U.S. nation to help. So why not helping them as well?
Well, what was exceptional.
So that's my journey.
What was exceptional about you, Prince, is, you know, when you contacted us, and I usually try to call people, you know, in Afghanistan, as you do such a good job, immediately. Like, there's no time between when we get a request for help and then we reach out. We try to make it almost as immediate. You know, we might not
be like, yeah, as far as they just like, as soon as we hear something, we just get them in touch, at least for them to give them the confidence, like, hey, I'm reviewing your case. Just give me a couple of hours or give me a day to get back to you. I got your email. I have it. This is my cell phone. I'm working on it. I'm working on your files, and we're getting help for you.
Yeah,
like immediately, basically. That's where you get in contact with people.
And you do such a good job of that. But, you know, even before, when you were still stuck in Afghanistan, you began doing work for us, and kind of dangerous work, going to check out checkpoints, going to different hotels and seeing the Taliban presence, which routes would be the best routes to get people to the airports or to Pakistan. And so even before you left Afghanistan, even before you got out of the country, you were already working, taking great risks, working with our organization to help us rescue other people. And then you, as an American citizen, a small business owner, it was a tragedy. How long were you in Afghanistan before you were able to get your wife out? When you finally got to UAE, what, December 1st?
December 1st, I arrived in USA. That was a thing. And then from late July, basically, I've been in Afghanistan. October 22nd, we flew out of Afghanistan to Doha, Qatar, and then been there for 40 days, and then came to U.S. on December 1st.
So when did you leave Afghanistan, finally?
October 22nd, 2021.
You know, it seems like that time from when we had first contact to when you finally were able to leave Afghanistan seemed like years. In my mind.
Yeah.
And for you, it must seem like decades.
Yeah.
But in my mind, it's like you look back and you say, okay, it was 2 months. But that 2 months, seemed like forever.
Yeah, different forever things. At one point, you're thinking like, well, you'll be here forever. And then not only that issue, like security-wise and the problem. And then my wife visa was, like, passport was about to get expired too. And I was like, okay, if the passport get expired, they'll be adding another issue on top of the problems we already have.
Can you can you say again what you just said about what would happen to your wife?
So the visa, the passport will get expired. So off of all the problems we have had, she had only 4 months left on the passport because, you know, that's how long the process took for her immigration visa. And then I was like, if the passport gets expired, then there will be another excuse for you know, State Department for not taking her to any plane because, okay, your passport is expired and there's no government there to renew your passport. And how do you go to the government or the Taliban to do the biometrics and get a passport renewal?
No, and you,
stressful, but
what you haven't talked about is, I mean, you risked your life because you actually snuck into Afghanistan when everyone else was trying to flee. You came across the border sneaking into Afghanistan to rescue your wife. That's an unbelievable story.
Yeah, when I arrived in Dubai, basically, the airport was already out of control. There was no, like, civilian control of the airport. Everything was, like, you know, like, everything was falling apart. So I had to flee to, like, from Dubai. I had to take a plane to go to Islamabad, Pakistan. From there, I drove to the border. Between the way of the border, on the border, there was, like, a small gas station. A type of gas station, but convenience store. I went there. I changed and wear all the Afghan, like, local clothing with a small turban on my head. Hid my American passport anywhere I could. It was only a backpack I had, so there was not much space for me to, like, hide it. But I did my best to put them on the packet of my clothing there to cross the border. So not showing, because at that time the Taliban already had the control of the border.
What would have happened if they found you with your American passport?
Definitely getting executed. Like, a lot of people that were missing or get like, you know, disappear from the city. That was, like, I would say, like, there's no doubt on that. Because even though the Taliban, they are the same, but the Taliban on the cities are a lot different than the ones on far villages, which is on the border, like Spinball, like something like that. They are absolutely out of control. Like, anything they do, there's no coordination between them and the people on the, like, the other people on the city. And who could find out about you about me if anything would have happened to me, like, on the border? Like,
yeah,
who could even go track me there?
Yeah, there are people we've been trying to help, women who have been set on fire, women who have been murdered, men who've been killed. And it just happens, and they're gone. And
yeah, it's just like they're gone. And
the mainstream media is not covering this anymore, right? It's wiped off the press.
Yeah, like, so many people getting disappeared and got disappeared. Like, I had a friend living next to a cemetery while I was there. He was saying in the middle of the night, the Taliban burying people in the ground. Like, in the middle of the night, who are these people? The people that got disappeared from somehow, somewhere.
So this is the risk you took to rescue your wife.
Yes.
Your in-laws must love you.
They do, for sure.
I mean, you're like the son-in-law that everyone dreams of.
When I came to the airport, I basically turned off my phone because everybody was calling me not to go. Like, hey, you're risking your life. Hey, it's too much. Don't do that. I was like, there are only two times you're risking your life for your country, for your family. That's what I believe. So I was like, it's the time for me to go in.
And you risked your life before this for our country, the United States. You risked it for Afghanistan. I want to set the stage for people, maybe take them back a little bit. So you served alongside U.S. Armed Forces, earning your U.S. citizenship, and then you moved here. And what year did you move to the United States?
2014. I moved to 2014 in the United States with a special immigrant visa called SIB for Afghans who helped U.S. government in Afghanistan.
And now there are so many people that we're trying to help that are SIVs that have just been totally forgotten and left.
Yes, so many of them. I have so many cases. So I'm working actively at least on over 100 cases like right now, only SIVs that they are in need of, you know, like financial help for sure to go to a different country because there's no embassy running in Afghanistan right now. So what we do right now, providing your passports, visa, accommodation, transportation from Afghanistan to Pakistan, finding safe house for them in Pakistan, trying to put, you know, like anything we can to like email call to the USCIS State Department to get their visa cases expedited or at least get them transferred to Pakistan to get them visa.
Yeah, I want to get to that. But before we get to that, I want to get to how you ended up sneaking across the border. So you come to the United States with nothing and you end up, where is your first job?
So I came to San Diego basically directly the same night in San Diego. There were some agencies that were helping immigrants to find job and apply for like benefits and stuff. So the next day I went there and I basically had no money left because at that time I was getting $650 and I was helping my family, supporting my family. I booked my own ticket. I didn't come with the U.S. government help to get my ticket. Even my first ticket, it was I paid out of my pocket. So any money I had, I paid for the ticket and I came here. And I had some money to pay for only 1 month rent here. And then no money left. So I went to this agency and they said, oh, we have to come here every day to teach you how to, you know, how you apply for job. And I told them, listen, I don't need your training to teach me how I apply for job. All I need is a bus pass. Give me a bus pass because I don't have any money. So I can go apply for job myself and print out my resumes. So they print out like, I don't know, 50 resumes and they give me a bus pass. At the time it was like $40 bus pass, so I could just get the bus, go like place to place looking for a job because you know, I didn't want to sleep, I didn't want to stay home and waiting for a job to come to me. I need to go and get the job basically. I grabbed, you know, the bus pass and going to the town to like every store I knew, like from car wash to restaurants everywhere, to apply for a job. And finally I ended up in downtown San Diego. There was a 7-Eleven store I stepped in. I'm basically thirsty and I walked all over the downtown, you know, to get my resume spray to apply for a job. I had my last dollar in my pocket. I was like super thirsty. I was trying to get something, but I couldn't get anything with a dollar in my pocket. There was only one thing called Arizona tea. We're selling those for 99 cents. So that was a 99 cents Arizona tea. I bought that Arizona tea, but in California, they charge CRV, 5 cents CRV. It's a recycling, some extra fee that they charge for the bottling and anything. So I was short 4 cents, but the guy was like, oh, you get it. Don't worry about the 4 cents. So I got that Arizona tea. And at that time, I hope one day I can have a position like this gentleman that working here, like as a cashier and at the store. So I started actually working there, and today I own that 7-Eleven.
I mean, this is unbelievable. So you go there, you're short 5 cents, 4 cents, because 4 cents. You know, the environmentalists are trying to save the earth. And the cashier, says, I got you, bro. And you get your Arizona tea. And I'm sure because you'd been working all day, that was like the best tea you'd ever had in your life.
It was, yeah. That was the best thing I could ever have because I was walking all over the town. So I get off the bus in one point of downtown. I was like going every single restaurant and store, giving my resume to everybody. Hey, do you need someone to work? Do you need someone to work? Because I didn't want to sit home and, you know, like just waiting again for the opportunity to come. The opportunities are outside the door. You need to step out and go get them.
And here you are. You know what I love about this story? I mean, this is an American dream story that you had. Here you are. You're the brightest guy I've ever met. I met a lot of bright guys. Like, you're in the top caliber of the brightest guys I've ever met. But you have the most robust nervous system of anyone I've ever met. You're just a cool cat under pressure. And I saw that when you were trapped in Afghanistan. You just were always really relaxed and optimistic. But here you were. You look, you're one of the smartest guys I've ever met, and you look at a cashier at 7-Eleven, and you say, if only one day I can have a job like this, this will be a dream.
Yeah.
And that job led to you owning that 7-Eleven. And how many years did it take you from the guy that couldn't afford the Arizona tea to the guy that owned the 7-Eleven?
3 years.
This is America. I see America this way because I'm dumb as rocks. I'm a high school dropout, was last in my class, and this country has given me so many opportunities. So when I hear other people who are much brighter than me, who've had a lot more opportunities than me, kvetch, I'm thinking, well, are you crazy? Like, anybody can achieve anything in this country. Here you were.
Of course.
Within 3 years, you come from the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And in 3 years, you are a small business owner, you're employing Americans who went through K-12 public school here, have big families and relationships all around, and you're employing them. It's really unbelievable.
Yes, correct. And I'm happy to do that. So here's the thing, Jason. I don't believe there's any closed door on you in this country. Okay. If you basically have to go to the door and they're opening on your face. I don't know why people are complaining. Well, nothing comes free, for sure. Like, if you're waiting for something to free come to you, it never happens, okay? Everything is here. All you need to do is just go and pursue and, you know, find them. Basically, that's how it is. And for me, I came from a country that my classroom was just like a destroyed house a destroyed house that was basically bombed during Russian. That was my classroom. Like, a piece of that was my classroom. We were painting black the wall to use them as a blackboard. No chair, no carpet or anything. We were sitting on the plastic. I remember we were splitting, me and my smaller younger brother were splitting a pencil in two pieces, so he can have one, I can have one. And then the notebooks that we were writing, we were cleaning them back again, erase them with the pencil, and then rewrite back again on top of that, because we were not able to afford anything. So that's how I came from, and then now here am I, because first, God helped me so much in every step of the way, and I tried to do my best and stay positive that things are possible to do if you want to do it. And that God will help you if you're willing to succeed.
You know, I like that. That's unbelievable that you were erasing, that you had to erase paper, the entire page, to reuse it again. And your classroom was not a building. It was the remnants of a building that had been bombed out. And this is the great frustration to me about Afghanistan that people don't know. That it was probably the safest country in the world in the 1960s. Americans, hippies from all over the world would traipse around. Then the Soviets sponsored a coup and then unleashed decades of hell, and then the United States showed up. And so the country of Afghanistan has suffered, and their people are suffering because of great powers that have trampled on that country. Is that's fair to say?
Yeah. So my dad used to tell me that, hey, we had, like, he was saying things that was unbelievable, like how Afghanistan in one point was like that, and now why we are like this. We are not the people that don't want a peace. We are the people who were kept away from the peaceful life. We were kept away. It's not us that wanted to stay away. We were kept away from the peace. We were kept away from having just a basic right of a human right. The basics, like what we need is like something to eat, a school to go, you know, freedom of choice. Like, the God created everybody free, so we should have the freedom of choice which way I want to live my life. But unfortunately, everything was taken away from us. And now when we come to the country like U.S. And some other countries like that, and hopefully most of us, we see the opportunity. We use every single opportunity that comes our way trying to build a life. It's a lot for us. It's like this. I always give that expression for the people who may not understand the value of this country, how beautiful, how great this country is. It's like a fish on the water. They don't know the value of the water until they're out of the water. Then they're all like desperately jumping from one side to the other. They want that water back. we may have challenges in the country. We may, the people, my point is the people who were born and raised here. The biggest challenge maybe for you is not to have an iPhone 13. You may have dealing with the iPhone 10 or whatever. But we have people like, and my, it's not too long ago. I'm talking about 20 years ago when I was like 8, 9 years old. I didn't have a notebook, a simple notebook could write on that. I was writing it and then cleaning it and rewrite again until there was like no way you could write on that. I wasn't using pen. I was using pencil, so I could just erase it and then rewrite it again on top of that. So this is the opportunity. This is the way the life we grow up. And it's not too far. It's just like on the other side of the world and the same way in the 21st century.
You know, you could accomplish here in 3 years what in other parts of the world, it would take families generations of disciplined, diligent work to move their family to that place, right?
Correct, yes.
And you said something that, you know, nothing comes for free, but in America, if you walk to a door, it opens. There's no closed doors. And to me, it's, I think in my life, I feel almost as if things just come for free. Like you walk to a door. I like how you put that. If you walk up to a door, the door is going to open.
Yeah.
But you have to walk up to the door.
You have to walk to that door. Everything is here, right? So in the 3 years, I was working like 10 hours, maybe, you know, 16 hours sometimes. On top of that, I was going to school to learn English. I was going to take my English classes. Under COVID, I took a break. My plan was to go to medical school, and I'm still pursuing. Hopefully, in one day, I can go back and, you know, like pursue that life. But for the COVID starting, everything like postponed it. You know, everything flipped off my way. But I was not only working. Like I was working during the day. At night, I was going to school, and then getting to the bus to go home because at the time I wasn't able to afford a car. Of course, you know, the beginning of the life. I was always falling asleep on my stop, and the bus driver was dropping me off the last stop. Like, hey, dude, no one is in the car. You'll fall asleep. So I had to get another bus to go back home because I was so tired of, you know, like.
So this is not easy. The American dream is not easy. And you were driving Uber eventually.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then when I got the car, basically got my driver license and got the car. So I was working from 7 to 3 and 7-Eleven, and then I was coming home, taking a nap, eating something for 3 hours. And then from 3 to 6, I was just eating or taking a nap. And then from 6 to 12 midnight, again, I was driving Uber. That was everyday thing on the weekdays. On the weekends, I was driving. Basically, I was leaving home on Friday afternoon for driving Uber and Lyft. I'm coming back Sunday afternoon. Home. I had a blanket in my car trying to go sleep here, not only to do something for myself because everybody in family was back home in Afghanistan. I was supporting them as well. So I was going there and I had a gym membership. I was sleeping in my car in the morning. I had the gym membership, going to the gym, take a shower, get back to the car, go back to work. That's how I was for like the first 3 years until I was able to accomplish something.
And so that 7-Eleven that you now own was earned with a lot of hard work for many, many years. You know, that idea of using the gym to shower, I did that. When I got out of the Army, I chose to live in my car. I never saw myself as homeless. I never felt sorry for myself. It just made sense. I was going to community college. I wanted to get my family from Hawaii to Chicago. And I thought, I'm working full-time the night shift at Home Depot, stocking shelves from 9 until 6 a.m. Then I'm going to community college. Why don't I just sleep at the library of the school and sleep in my car? And then I joined a martial arts school that was really cheap. And I thought, I can just go there, train when I can, and shower. And I can shower at the gym at the school. And then I was watching a television show this week, one of these like American Idol shows. And this guy talked about being homeless and how he got a $19 a month gym membership so he had a place to shower. And that's, I think... Did you ever, you're an optimistic guy, when you were going through any of this, did you ever just feel despair? Did you ever feel hopeless? Did you ever?
No. Never. I always optimistic. I always think good things come to me because I want good things for other people. That's my wish. So, and I don't see that as anything comes to my way. We always, so what I look into this is like that. Yes, if they ask me, like, did you have a bad day? I tell them, no, I did not have a bad day. I had a challenging day. The days are challenging. They're not bad. They're just different. They're just difficult. I don't name any day bad day. They're all good days because they're all things to do. They're all, there's another opportunity for you to do something. So, yeah, if you ask me, have you ever been challenging in the life? For sure, my life was full of challenge. From one point selling banana on the streets of Afghanistan, to now, you know, owning a 7-Eleven, having employees there. And when I look at my employee, I don't look at them as an employee. I look at them as a part of my family. I look at them as myself being there in one point in the back. Try to, you know, help them. Try to do anything I can to convince them that this is not what, you know, this is not what you should be. It's a good start, but you need to be high. You need to push your way up. There's a lot of opportunity for you, waiting for you to do something if you want.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what frustrates me when I hear a lot of people talking about minimum wage jobs or starting jobs, and they'll complain about what these starting levels are. You know, when I got out of the Army, I started at less than $6 an hour to work the night shift, and I tried to get 60 hours a week so I could get 20 hours at $9 an hour. But these jobs, are just great opportunities.
You're learning.
You're learning a lot. You're developing fortitude and skill sets and how to deal with people and managers and customers that can take you anywhere in life, right? If you can work the cashier, if you're a cashier at 7-Eleven, you're learning skills that you can be a realtor one day in Beverly Hills with the people skills you're learning.
Exactly. So I started with $8 an hour. And my employer told me that, hey, which is my best friend now, he said that, hey, I don't have a full time for you and I don't have a morning shift. I can only offer you a night shift. I told him, listen, I don't care what shift you give me, but I have a request because I'm using bus. Give me a shift that I can take my latest bus, which was at 11 p.m. if you can. And then I told him, like, once you see me working, if, you know, and then from what I do, then you can definitely see what position I need to be fit in or what position I need to get in. So I started my training. On the first week of training, he came back to me like, hey, Prince, you will be working in the morning shift, not afternoon shift, and I will give you a full-time shift. And I told him, like, David, his name was David, he's like, hey, if you're giving me this job and taking somebody else out, I'm not going to take it. I'm not here to take somebody else's, you know, position or opportunity. I'm here to, you know, like, get my space. So, and then he said, no, there's no, I don't take anybody else's job. So he had to call the guy who was working in the morning to call him to talk to me and say, like, hey, I want to work night shift because I have school in the morning. Then I was convinced to take the morning shift because I was like, I like the morning shift. That's great. But I don't want you to put me there because you want to take somebody else. I don't want to take somebody else's position or because everybody can succeed without pushing anybody else out of their way. They can just, you know, everybody has their own way and their own position set for them. But they need to just work through that.
So it took you a week to get from the night shift to the day shift. When I got out of the Army, this is a true story. I get out of the Army. It took me 8 weeks to find a job. I felt so depressed. It was the only time I took unemployment. I got unemployment, I think, for 1 week. And that 8 weeks seemed like eternity. I finally get this job at Home Depot. And they would not let me work the day shift because they said my teeth were too much. I had these really bad fake teeth. I had my teeth knocked out. And I had really ghetto fake teeth. And they would. The management said, look, with those teeth, we can't have you working during the daytime. And it took me maybe 9 months of the night shift to finally get to work during the day. I was actually like the evening in the paint department. I was doing night stuff. So it took you a week as a new immigrant from Afghanistan. It took you a week to get to the day. It took me 9 months. That's all. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah. So, and then I had to work, like, prove to him that I can, you know, I'm here to do anything. So I got started a job in the morning time. And then during those weeks, I got, like, really back. So sometimes when it comes to a difficult time, you have to find your way out. I had a toothache, like really bad tooth problem. So I went to these places and they told me like it cost me $1,800 for a root canal and bridge. I was like, well, I don't have that much money to pay. And that was too much money for me to pay. It still is too much money. Like $1,800 is a lot for a lot of people, right? So I had to like think like what to do. So finally, I ended up going to Mexico to fix my teeth. Even though like I was even new in the U.S. Like I had to find a way.
You told me that. How did you figure that out? What made you think I'm going to go to Mexico? What made you think that?
Yeah. So I was walking like basically all night in my apartment, like for my teeth was like really bad, swallowing my face. I didn't have any option. And next morning I was going to work because I went to work. Some of the customers that were coming in, they told me like, hey, what's the problem? Like what? Because what happened? Like my face was like swollen, like it's really bad. Because everybody could see, like it's different. And they asked me, and one of them was like, okay, this is a problem. So why are you not going to the doctor? I told them, well, because it's expensive. I can't afford $1,800 to do something like this. And they told me like, hey, why are you not going to Mexico? I was like, where is it? I said, yeah, it's just like, you know, like 45 minutes from San Diego. You just take a blue line bus trolley and then go drop off at the border and then cross the border, go to Mexico. There's a lot of dentists there. They'll fix your teeth very cheap. So, and I listened. I was like, okay, well, it's the first time I go there. A lot of people were saying a lot of crazy things about Mexico, like, hey, in TJ, like you go there, there's a lot of, you know, problem can happen to you and whatever. I was like, I'm sure it's not worse than Afghanistan. So
you're like, hold my beer. I'm going.
Yeah, I'm going.
When I lived in LA, I would cross the border just to watch boxing matches because I liked watching famous Mexican boxers on the Mexican side of the border, and everyone thought I was crazy. So going for dental work makes sense.
Yeah, I went there and fixed it for, I think, $200, which was a lot. That was my almost whole week of paycheck, but it's still worth it because my teeth was like killing me at night. So yeah, I fixed that and came back. So everything, you know, takes time. Everything you do, takes some effort to put in. Again, I believe like anything you want, you can achieve in this country, but if you're willing to work for it.
So here you are now, you've worked hard, you've driven Uber, you've worked at 7-Eleven, you've made friends, you've got money together and you buy your own 7-Eleven. And correct, now yeah. It's the summer of 2021.
Yeah. And so not only that, I bought my first house in 2020.
And you were taking pictures of that house and FaceTiming and showing your wife, I imagine.
Yes.
This is your home. Exactly. You're like, this is going to be where you live.
Yeah. I was showing her the picture of that. So I got the big house, very fortunate to have it. Like 3,057 square footage of house, which is also a dream for me to come through. Like housing. In one point, I remember like thinking like, well, what if one day you can even like I wasn't even able to afford an apartment. Like not too long ago, I was living for like with 5-6 people in one bedroom apartment just to split the cost of it. And now see what God given me so far.
And you're showing this to your wife?
Yes.
And you got married in what year?
2019.
And you've been working on her visa since that very day?
Correct.
And you're an American citizen?
Yes.
You're a small business owner? And yes. The visa wasn't moving. And so now it's...
No.
When did you realize that Afghanistan would collapse and you needed to go get your wife?
So I was in Afghanistan twice last year. I don't know if I told you or not. One was around April. I went there basically to visit my family and hope that I hear something from the State Department by then for a visa interview for my wife, because all the process was done. So nothing happened. Things was normal in Afghanistan in April. You know, like May also, it was normal. I came back on June to U.S. By the end of the June, you could see that there's problems like raising. It seems like as soon as I left Afghanistan, everything was changed. Things definitely changed. And came to July, like around July 15, basically, I cut the call in twice to the State Department, send them email to transfer the case because things were getting out of the control. Around late July, I'll say 28 or 27, I had to call back again, and I asked him, like, hey, give my wife at least a pass because she's been waiting for a visa for almost 2 years now. Everything, all the documents you needed was submitted. All the fee for the visa were paid. I showed enough income that can support her, and she will not be in any of the public benefits. All we need is just a visa interview schedule and she get the visa and come home. That's all. But unfortunately, they said no. And then when Herat fall, which was the other side of the country, that gave me the idea of that, you know, if a city like Herat or Mazar-e-Sharif fall, Kabul will definitely fall because they are, you know, they are the bridge. If they fall, the rest of the country will definitely fall. When Herat fall, at that time, like, okay, Afghanistan is out of control. There is no way it can survive. At that time, I decided to flee in Afghanistan. By the time I got there, like every day, another city was falling into the Taliban. And then when I reached to the border, basically crossing, already the border was falling into the Taliban's hands. But I had to go through the Taliban hand, basically pass them, see them for the first time after 20 years, basically. From very close and see their white flag, which at one point it was the scariest thing ever you could see, but now it's in front of your face. Basically, you just go talk to them to get the pass to Afghanistan.
I mean, their guard must have been down. They didn't think an American was going to be coming across the border from Pakistan, right? I mean, they were probably not imagining that.
No one, because if you're seeing people was lined up on the border, who is that crazy person to cross in at this time? I was Prince, so I did it.
Yeah, well, praise God. And what do you think would have happened to your wife if you didn't go into the country? What would her life be like right now?
I thought this is a you know, like, not a great time to go, but if they get more stable there, then they may not even let people to leave, which they are doing the same thing now. You know, we have to smuggle people out of their hands to send to a different country. So imagine that was my estimate, and that happened to a lot of people. And if my wife had didn't have the passport, because the passport were getting expired in 4 months, and then we were living in Herat, which is a small city, and if someone, you know, like, find out, which I'm sure that a lot of people know me, that I'm in America, you know, like, my wife is still there. I work with American forces. That will be definitely a big problem for her and the rest of the family. And at this time, when everybody, like, all the Taliban are not imagining or not thinking, like, who's coming in and out, I thought that would be a good time to just go grab her and run out. Because if they secure more the border, if they bring more the biometric system on the border, things will getting harder every day.
Did you think it was going to be easier than it was? Were you surprised at how hard it was for you to get your wife out of the country?
So the way that they were saying and promising, I thought it would be, like, super easier than it is. A lot of people getting into, like, if 100,000 people can get in the plane and come home, I'm a U.S. citizen with a blue passport, with the background of help, like, helping and serving with the U.S. military in Afghanistan. I should definitely be able to take her, not only her, you know, even, like, some people brought the rest of the family home too. I was like, okay, that's easy. I can go and, you know, bring her at least, like, in maybe a week or two. But unfortunately, as soon as I got there, things were not as I was thinking.
You know, we call him John on the show. His code name is John. But the retired intelligence officer that was working with us and with you to get, you know, to help us get you money right away, and my good friend, you know who John is, right? We call him John. So on the show,
yeah,
he's been a guest, but we always use the name John. You know, we were saying, do they want this guy to die? We just could. Yeah. We said, are they trying to get him killed? That's what we felt. Like, why? We're like, why? What is the U.S. government doing to this U.S. citizen, and why? It was bizarre. It was baffling to us.
So I was the first one. I can definitely, you know, like, prove that I was the first one to raise the voice after US force withdrawn from Afghanistan on the 30th of August, when President Biden came to the TV like, oh, all the U.S. citizens are in safety. I was the first one grabbing my phone, calling like, hey, no, this is not right. I'm in Kabul with my blue passport on hand. Why you're not telling the truth to the people? And I told him I will share that with all Americans, that there are so many more Americans in the country and I will be a voice for them. The next thing was I was contacted with a reporter from Intercept, Marteza. So he contacted me like, hey, this is what happened. He's like, are you willing to do the interview? Like, for sure, why not? And he also warned me that things will happen, if we do share that interview, like there's things can happen to you, because you could go, like people will think you're against the government or something. Like, I'm not against the government or anything. I'm against the policy. I'm against the way that they are evacuating. I'm against the things that they do and also trying to cover up for Americans that they don't want to learn. They don't want to like hear about it. I was like, I will be the worst and I don't care what's going to happen. Because my wife is still having immigrant visa processing. They could just deny that or do anything to that, bring up an excuse. So after my interview on the 31st, I called my article was released on the 2nd of September. Yes. Same day or the next day, U.S. Department came back and said, oh, we still have 80 Americans in the country. They changed the number. And then from that, I was just speaking. I had 5-6 interviews from Afghanistan when I was there with Fox News and some other agencies. And
no, we had to beg you, if you remember. We had to beg you not to do a Fox News. I think Tucker Carlson or something. I'm like, look, if you remember my line, it was evacuation, then retribution. Well, let's evacuate you, and then we'll have
the link.
Yeah, I was like, let's get you evacuated, and then we'll have years to exact and exert retribution, but let's get you out of there first. And by God's grace, I don't think you didn't do that interview, did you?
So we didn't. So the interview was supposed to do in Kabul, but I did that in Qatar.
Yeah,
I did that in Qatar. So I waited on that Kabul. But in Qatar, I did two Fox interviews in Qatar, and then when I came to US, I just had to do like one, like so many more.
Yeah, no, you've done
I'm
a
still
lot.
Doing it.
So here we go. So it was quite the adventure to rescue your wife. Then eventually you make it to the United States December 1st. I tell you on December 1st, and I didn't want you to feel obligated to help us, but I said, Prince, you know, I've been to war zones. Your nervous system's going to crash. You're going to sleep for 2 or 3 weeks. And you've been under immense stress. But when you feel better, give me a call. You called me like the next day and you said, I'm ready to help. And I hear you. I hear you. Like ringing people up at 7-Eleven, you're back to your business, calling me, not even 24 hours later, and you're like, let's go. Let's start saving people.
So I arrived on Wednesday, I believe. It was a Wednesday. The next day I was in the store bringing out people, and we were in contact.
So this is what I want to share with folks. So we've had multiple teams working on the ground in Afghanistan. And they were all beautiful people, and they all did their best. A lot of the teams, you know, we learned who was efficient and who could get the job done. A lot of people were just crushed mentally and emotionally by the burden, and they did their best for as long as they could. These were our Afghan partners, but the weight of the responsibility and the sorrow and the tragedies that just happen in this work every day could be just too much. And about the time you came home, you immediately jumped into it. And then you were able to build for us not only an efficient, I hate calling it a rat line, a railroad, an underground railroad, a route. You were able to develop with your friends really efficient, cheap, and cheap is important, right? Because we only have so much money. We're a very small nonprofit. And you were able to develop really cheap, cost-effective routes out of the country, safe houses across Pakistan and Afghanistan. But maybe more importantly than even the ability to evacuate people cost effectively was you just developed the system to distribute food almost anywhere right. in Afghanistan within 24 hours. So as winter approached,
everywhere.
We were able to distribute food to how many families do you think just your operation alone distributed food to this winter?
900, at least 900 families all over the country.
And your
within a month.
And your responsibility was we worked with other communities where they would be a whole village and we would distribute food in one place and everyone would come down. But what you were doing was quite different. These were people hiding in attics. So when you say 900 people, these are 900 of the most vulnerable people.
So 900 families, which if we come up with the 5 or 6 member of the family, each will be around like 4,000 or 5,000 people.
And these are 4,000 or 5,000 people in jeopardy, starving, in hiding.
Yeah.
And you were able to bring in the farthest away villages, and you were able to deliver food. And sometimes there was one family I talked to, the infant and the grandmother were starving, and you got them food within hours.
Yes. And they were definitely, I remember that family and so many more. They were at the point of the country that we reached that people were eating grass and a sort of food because they didn't have the food to eat. And based on what they say, we were the only group that distributed a full package of the food, which they were saying in the last 20 years they haven't seen something like that. We were definitely giving a food that will last the people like a complete package for 3 to 4 months for each family. So that was a lot. Like some group were giving them oil, only oil, like what they can do with oil if they don't have anything to cook the oil with. But we were giving them oil, flour, rice, beans, potato, like a full package, including medicines. So that was huge.
And in some places, I mean, your team had to use donkeys.
Yes. In some places, there were no, I still have the pictures. I think I sent it to you too, that there were no like route, like an actual street commute. We had to use donkeys to get the food to the farthest place. And our group, they were on the front line. It's not like we coordinated things. No, we were on the front line with those people in those far villages. And somehow they had to travel like 24 hours driving in the mountain in like villages to get that food to that farthest point of the city on the village.
And these families would have died. These would have been thousands of families that would have died this winter. And
on winter, yeah.
You know, when we're looking at the mainstream media covering the great sorrow that's happening in Ukraine, I think it's fair to say that just let's say the month of February and the month of March, more Afghans will have died in March than Ukrainians. You think that's fair to say?
Yes, of course.
From famine and from exposure.
Yes, so much more of that. Like Ukraine, it's heartbroken. I feel the pain. I grew up in the war. I know how the war is. Like painful the war is, how bad the war is. But for Ukrainian, if they cross the border, they will be sleeping in Finland, they will be sleeping in Poland, they will be sleeping in Germany. But in Afghanistan, they don't have the nicest neighbor ever. No, we got problem with the neighbors. And one hand is Iran that they can't send people there because of the government. They have very beautiful people, very beautiful country, but the government has problems. And the other hand, the same thing with Pakistan. Like you're sending the people in Pakistan, they're not even safe there. And this is the only two countries that right now it's available to send people, and none of them are like some of the families there, even like they get in more trouble going to those countries because they have to register with the police and they have to do so on. So, yeah, I wish Afghanistan had at least one good neighbor. Poland, like Germany, like Finland, or something like that, so we could send people there.
I've been saying that. I'm like, if only Afghanistan bordered Poland, this would have been a much easier job. You know, when we started getting requests to rescue Ukrainians, eventually we said, look, we're not going to help you. Just go to Poland, quick. Get in your car and just cross the border. Just go. And because we initially we set up like we did in Afghanistan, okay, and we did. We had to go rescue. We rescued schools. We're rescuing children, schools for the blind. We've rescued. We've emptied maternity wards, things like that. But generally, you know, thousands of people we were able to say, just go to Poland. Just go now.
Yeah,
go.
I wish I could say something like that to the people who are reaching out to us. No. We have, as soon as they reach out, I can't tell them to go. I tell them, okay, let me review your documents. So let me get back to you. And then I send the documents to another group. They review that, you know, sending for the visa process to see if there's any missed documents. Visa get done. Visa get back to me. I send the visa back on the ground. I have to call in a couple more security calls before sending someone to the room to see if there's any, everything is okay, like there's no external like extra security on the road or whatever, because sometimes they have some extra checkpoints on the road that they ask more identities and ask more stuff, and then send a call to them and coordinate people.
In August, in September, Pakistan was asking for COVID tests.
Yes.
Could you imagine this? They were saying, well, you need a COVID test before we'll let you cross
the border. Yeah, that's what they were saying, COVID test. And then at this time, there was no, like, how could you get a COVID test?
Like, go to Walgreens. Can't they just go to Walgreens?
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
CVS.
Yeah, just go to CVS, guys. Look, CVS. I'm in Texas. You know, I'm trying to go to Rome, and I had to go to, before I, you know, came here, I had to go to the CVS. I had to get a test. It was hard in, like, the most affluent place in America to time the test has to be done within 72 hours. You expect, you know, thousands of refugees in Afghanistan as they arrive at the border of Pakistan to have a COVID test in the past 72 hours. It's utterly unbelievable. And this is...
No, there's no way.
So can we... I want to get to... you know, I want folks to understand the challenge of Afghanistan, that what people are going through. And maybe we can do two things. One is I want you to share... really the most daring rescue I think your family, your friends pulled off a couple of weeks ago. And then maybe after that, we can walk folks through what is the process once we get someone evacuated from Afghanistan, but we're still not even halfway, we're not even to the 50-yard line yet. I think getting them out of Afghanistan to a lily pad is just the 25-yard line. We still have 75 yards to go. And they're a hard 75 yards. Can you share about what happened a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, we can share like some details, but not really deep details on that for security wise, because we do have a mission there still going. So just something that say what type of people we rescued, I think.
Yeah, share whatever you feel comfortable
idea
with.
Is like, okay. So we have had this 21 years old girl that was getting forced marriage to a Taliban member in 2 days. So we basically had to get them out of in a hospital from in a hospital, like make it like a fake sickness, and then send them to the hospital and grab them from the hospital and cross them to the border to a country that, you know, we don't want to mention it, but it was the most, you know, like, we had to, at some point, we had to use a wheelchair to cross because we didn't want him to, you know, like, question her or something like that, and had to find a family to just be, you know, be with her as, like, acting as a family member, because Taliban are stopping people, the girls, the females, that they don't have anyone, like, any man accompany with them. So I had to find an old couple to just be with them, with her to go across, you know.
Yeah, so you had to really, and this was a request that came in, and we don't even look really, you know, we get so many requests. It was just in the queue. Just like this week, we have somebody, I don't want to say her name, but, you know, we have a young woman that's targeted that we're hoping to get out this week. But she was just, this young woman was in the queue at the time. I had actually said to you that I vote against it. It's just too dangerous because I didn't want to put our teams in jeopardy. And you came back to me and said, Jason, this young woman will kill herself or be killed the next 12 months if we don't attempt to rescue her. Yeah. And you pried her away from radicals who were forcing her into a marriage or abusing her, beating her. And and it was intense. One day we'll be able to tell the whole story. It was just very intense. Yeah. And it was like out of a movie. You could make a movie just on that one operation. And, but this is something that you and your team are doing every day. And strangely, this is the easy part, right? So rescuing, getting somebody across the border, and so many of our friends that are listening in Afghanistan and Pakistan and in Humanitarian City, I want you guys to understand, and also the Jason Jones Show audience and the Vulnerable People Project supporters to understand, getting someone to Humanitarian City or into Pakistan is in our control. We can do that. But permanently resettling a refugee once they're in Pakistan or in another lily pad like Humanitarian City, that is not in our control at all.
No. So that's another issue. Like, we are not government agency. We don't have the government power. I wish we had. I would definitely help so many more people. I was like, if the government gives me one day of their power, I would do a lot more. But unfortunately, we don't have that. We can only do as much as it's under our control, like getting people visa, passports, sending transportation, sending the food, getting a safe house, transporting from Afghanistan to another country, like Pakistan, Iran, not Iran, like Pakistan, basically, is that our safe house, basically. And then once they're out there, then they have to, we have to still fight to see if we can get them somewhere. All we can do is making some calls and emails. That's all we can do. And we are even willing to pay for their tickets if they have a visa. If they grant a visa for them anywhere in any of the European country or American country, we can definitely work on to get them the tickets and all the other stuff. But unfortunately, we don't have that power to get them visa or something. We can just save them temporarily from one point to the other to send them to the Pakistan, and then the government needs to act to do more to resettle those people.
And that's one of the reasons I'm in Europe this week and next week. We're looking just beyond the United States for opportunities to resettle migrants, to resettle refugees. We're looking anywhere
people
in the world.
Anywhere.
We're looking anywhere in the world. But it's something I think sometimes they feel we've forgotten them, or, oh, it's so easy, you got us to Pakistan. How come you can't get us from Pakistan to Germany or to Sweden or to Canada or the United States? And it's completely outside of our control. And we've been so focused on keeping people alive through the winter, and this call Biden's winter of death, with food and coal for heat. We didn't talk about all the coal we distributed. We're rescuing people that we know are in imminent danger, getting them across the border, but the next challenge, and really the most expensive part, is the permanent resettlement. It's going to be very expensive. Countries like Canada will let us resettle people up to, but we're going to need to find $20,000 to $50,000 per refugee to resettle them. And that's a lot of money for a little organization like ours. And at the end of the day, it's going to need to be very large aid organizations. We're even looking at getting a loan. I'm talking to a bank right now over a $3 million 30-year loan so that we can make loans out to families and they can pay us back as we pay the bank back, and we're going to see how that works. But it's in a seemingly intractable situation. There's no such thing as an intractable situation, but there are situations that seem impossible. And for us right now, to be honest, it's we're staring at a brick wall. But we're going to find a way to knock down this brick wall.
Yeah, but whatever we do is saving, definitely saving people's life. It's not like a lot of people like in Afghanistan, right? So in this week, basically only in this week, we were able to get 15 Pakistani visas. It's a lot at this time. Like all the passports are, the visas are banned basically. And at the same time, we were able to extend and renew another 15 to 16 visas that they were in Pakistan already, taking people to doctor if they need any, doctor attention, which we had two cases this week only. These are the stuff that we've been doing every day to do anything that's in our control to control it. But unfortunately, there are more things that need to be done, but it's out of our control. We want to do it, but we can't. I love to start to get people directly a ticket. Be like, hey, here's your ticket and visa, come to US. And I will definitely go pick them up from airport. Unfortunately, I don't have, we don't have that power. I wish we had. But yeah, everyday things, we, if we didn't do something like that, even with the passport, you know, visa, you know, stuff from Afghanistan out, people will definitely die there. There are people that have been targeting. Like, I'm getting 24/7 texts and emails from people desperately asking for help. Like, hey, I need to go. I'm taking anywhere. Just take me to a safe house and anywhere in the country or outside to, you know, just be safe. That's what they're asking the most.
Yeah, and as we're receiving these messages 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they come in through Facebook, through WhatsApp. You said that, you know, they find us through emails we forgot we had. They find us through every LinkedIn.
They send me on Facebook. They send me Facebook messages and so on.
Yeah, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Signal. They find us, and it's all day, every day. But most people that don't listen to the Jason Jones Show, even my own wife says, you know, honey, if you weren't my husband, I would think that everything was okay in Afghanistan. I would think that everyone was out that should be out. I wouldn't know that there's a famine. I wouldn't know of any of this if you weren't my husband. And she's like, and I forget sometimes that I'm startled when I overhear you on the phone. It's striking to me how the mainstream media has just moved along.
Yeah, like basically turned the face away from Afghanistan. And of course, this, you know, like administration definitely loves to do that, because like now Ukraine, they were saying, oh, it's not our problem. Like, well, that Russia didn't get along, but they were trying to bring up the Ukraine war on the media. They're trying to cover the mess they did in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's
and
not,
we're trying to bring it back.
You know, it's not going to work, and I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but I blame them for this Ukraine disaster. Under Trump made it clear that Ukraine wouldn't become a part of NATO. And the mainstream media tries to say that Trump weakened NATO by saying that and encouraged Putin to do this. It's quite the opposite. Under Obama, Putin invaded Ukraine. Under Biden, Putin invaded Ukraine. Under Trump, Putin did not invade Ukraine. And so NATO rattling the bear's cage, poking the bear, and then when the bear steps on civilians all across the Ukraine, they go, oh, the horror. But, you know, on my show yesterday, I had John Smirak on. The Brookings Institute was gloating at how great of an opportunity this is to lure Russia into a 10, 20-year quagmire in Ukraine. What a despicable, disgusting thing to say. What a great opportunity it is to turn Ukraine into a hell on earth to weaken Russia. That's just disgusting.
Yeah, and then basically it's people losing their lives. It's you know, like there's like why they're doing their policy is when and like putting people's in front line. So like Afghanistan part, you know, you just switch it and give it to the, you know, the Taliban, and then on the other hand you're telling people to jump into the plane. Like how is that even possible? How many people you were able to bring up? And the people you brought in, there's no clear path for them. They have only humanitarian parole visa stamp on their passport, which after 2 years unclear what's going to happen to them. Do they get back deported to Afghanistan? What's going on with them? No one knows.
You know, I said I would never serve in government. Like I would never work at USAID or State Department. I was offered a position in the last administration. This is impressed upon me how important it is, political appointees in places like state and USAID, and how important it is that people who actually are thoughtful to the vulnerable and our national interest go into those jobs. Because it takes a real hero to climb into those disgusting bureaucracies and fight the trench warfare day in and day out, drinking crappy coffee, having a little cubicle, you know, where you pin up a picture of your family, and then you're surrounded by lunatics. And you have to go into meetings with lunatics and Zoom calls with lunatics, but you do it because you're there to serve your nation and the common good. But what Afghanistan taught me was just how devoid of natural human emotions most of the people who work at State Department are. They're zombies. I don't, devoid of empathy.
I remember one time when I called in, when I was in Afghanistan, I called that emergency, U.S. citizen emergency hotline. I called in, I was like, hey, I'm in Afghanistan, you know, the flights are going, like, I'm not getting called. What's the plan? What do you need to do? And literally that person was Googling some information for me. I was like, no, I don't need those information that you reading. So he was reading an article. She was reading an article for me. Like, okay, the article you're reading, I told him, like, I have it on the Google. So you're an emergency hotline. So give me an answer. Like, what do I need to do now? Like, what's the point? She was like, well, at this point, we don't have anything to tell you. Basically, we don't know. We don't have any update. And I asked her, like, okay, well, then who should I call for help? If you're like a hotline, you're a citizen hotline, and you're not helping, you're not telling me anything to help, then who should I call for help? The Taliban? That was my question, like, you know, like out of like creativity, like, who should I call them? The Taliban? Should I call the Taliban to help? She told me, call whoever you think can help you at this time. So imagine. How can you say something like that to someone desperately asking for a life? And you're getting
an American paid. Citizen.
Yes. And you're getting paid from this person's tax money and so many more like him to have that position, to pick up the phone and find a way for them to out, you know, to help. And you're telling them, go call the Taliban basically to help you. We don't help.
Here's what I know, Prince. Here's what I know, Prince. That person who took your call makes more money than me, gets vacation days. Oh, guaranteed. No, guaranteed. Has vacation days. I don't have vacation days. Come on. They have a benefits package, you know, that I wish that I could have for my family. They're these government employees. But yet, when your friend saw me on EWTN, my salary is paid 100% by me raising money. All the aid that we spend, I'm the development department here. I called you within a second of me getting the email.
I was like, yeah, let's help. And same thing what we do right now.
And that's what you do. And you're not getting paid. you're running your own business. And so we're not. What we're saying is, if you work at the State Department and you're listening to this, we know you can do better because we do better than you. And we don't have
not even getting any support.
And we're not the United States government. We're not a huge government agency with an immense budget. No, we're not that. We're a small nonprofit that I literally have to go down a database and start calling for money when we run out so we can meet all the needs for everyone we're trying to support. You're saying, I hear the bell at the 7-Eleven. I hear the door open and we're on a three-way call with me, you, someone in Afghanistan, and you're talking to a customer, and I'm like, do we need to call you back? You're like, no, I got this. And you're giving great customer service to the guy there at 7-Eleven. And we're arranging a massive evacuation of prominent folks from Afghanistan. So what we're saying is, it's not that we know the State Department could do better. We do better.
They can do it, definitely.
And we don't have the resources they have. So it's startling to me.
Yeah, and then you just like basically, what's the point of, you know, having that position, having that department on, especially for Afghanistan when there's no help? Like, why would you even pay the extra there?
And if they're not helping Afghanistan in the midst of a crisis, tell me like then, where are they useful?
Yeah.
Imagine if after 9/11, the New York Fire Department just wasn't present during 9/11.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it is. That's exactly how it works. And then even in one point, because I was hearing the State Department saying like, well, we tried to call U.S. citizens, but they denied to come to the plane. I called and I was like, is U.S. citizen considered the one who has a blue passport? That was my questioning. They said yes. I told them, okay, then if that's the one, I'm one of them. And no one called me to be in any plane. So why are you lying to me? I thought, like, in one point there, I told them maybe they have a definition, like, they have a different definition of a U.S. citizen, not the one we have, basically, but.
Yeah, what would their definition be? I mean, they're processing Ukrainians in 72 hours.
Yeah, I told him, like, why you think I told him, because maybe I have an accent. That put me on the bottom of the line. That's what I asked him. Like, what makes a U-citizen? Someone with a blue passport? I have it. But no one called me. Like, why are you saying that you called the U.S. citizen and they didn't pick up the phones?
Well, we know from people we were working with that Afghans, U.S. citizens who are Afghan, were passed up, were pushed to the back of the line.
Yeah, I was like that. I was in flight 13 after the 31st.
But Americans that look like me, I'm just stating the facts. Under this quote-unquote progressive administration, Americans that look like me, is it maybe because to have a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy dragged behind an American Humvee that the Taliban was driving would be bad press, but they could kind of cover up, if Prince Wafa's shot by the Taliban, that they can hide that. They'll make sure that's not on the evening news, but if Jason Jones is being dragged behind a Humvee that the Taliban is driving with holes through my body, well, that's going to be a big news story. So let's get all the blonde hair, blue-eyed guys to the front of the line. I mean, that is what that's what happened, right? I mean, this is what happened.
That's what happened, but they didn't realize that Prince has a big mouth on him.
No, and Prince wrote out World for Breitbart and was on Fox News and
everywhere.
No, they
Google my name.
Google me, bro. I'm Prince Wafa.
Google me, bro.
Yeah, the biggest mistake they made, I tell you now, I can say it now, is they let you out.
When I came in Qatar, basically, like, as soon as I had my passport, like, oh, that name is familiar. I was like, of course it is.
That's funny. They said that. Well, when John was calling them, the State Department to get you out.
Yeah.
They were calling you a liar. Oh, he's a liar. He didn't. We called him. You know, these Afghans. This is what John was like. I should have recorded this person. He said, this person was. It's like, Prince Wafa's a liar. All those Afghans are liars. We called all of them. Because you don't make mistakes. Like, Prince Wafa must have been the guy that gave him $58 billion of U.S. weapons, too. That Prince Wafa. Wow, he's done a lot.
That was me.
That was you.
Like, am I? Like, if I'm a liar by saying no one called me, like, what do you name yourself when you say no Americans in Afghanistan and they end up to be like 4,000 or 5,000 of them left?
Or when Joe Biden says on July 6th, Afghanistan won't fall and 85% of the districts had fallen by July 6th.
Yeah, I was like, what do you name yourself if you say that to me?
You know what? A proper response would be, I'm sorry, Mr. Wafa. It's a challenging situation. We're trying to call everyone. I apologize if we weren't able to reach you or we weren't able to call you. That would be something to assume that maybe we didn't call you.
Or if you were, so there was not an actual call, like how they were doing, like they were sending a general message to anyone, no matter if they're a U.S. citizen, green card holder, or someone just like an Afghan local found the email of the U.S. Task force, whatever they were naming it. The email, like, hey, I want to go to America. They were sending a general email to everybody, like, hey, make your way to Hamid Karzai International Airport. How do you make your way to Hamid Karzai International Airport when there are, like, thousands of people, like, miles of people waiting there with so many Taliban checkpoints, the people that you've been fighting for the last 20 years? On the front line or the back, basically with your tax money.
People being shot, bombs going off. Yeah, just go.
Like, how can you go, basically, show your passport? Hey, I'm an American citizen. I'm the one who helped U.S. forces to go kill your terrorists. Can you give me a pass to go to the airport? Like, how is that even possible? That was my question from the State Department. Like, how can we're becoming the best friends with these people in overnight? Like, how can you tell me go there, show your passport, and they will let you go? Like, how is there a guarantee? And I have the email says the safety is not guaranteed. Of course it's not.
It's startling. Unbelievably startling. The fact that you and your wife made it. I mean, we were begging you to let us take you out over land, and you had the discipline to wait to eventually get on a plane. And a lot of the credit goes to Congressman Daryl Issa, who fought for you. But, you know, we had given up. I mean, John and I and our team were just, please let us just take you to Pakistan. But you understood rightly that that came with a lot of risks for you as an American citizen as well.
And a lot of risk, and plus, if you go to Pakistan, what's the chance? Because the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan never replied to any of my requests as an American. Like, I just keep emailing them, like, hey, can you accept my wife's kids? Can you do this? Can you do that? They never reply to any of the emails I've sent to them. Like, how could I be like, okay, I go there and then they will help me? Like, I could come.
Could you imagine that you have an American citizen stuck on hell on earth and they do not respond to your emails? By the way, it wasn't just the U.S. State Department. A lot of large American corporations, big military contractors, large NGOs, a lot of their people that they just abandoned there would reach out to us. And when we would reach out to their former employer, we would get form emails basically absolving them of responsibility for their former employees, that they were on their own. And it's something I just couldn't begin to imagine. So it's something that transcends just the culture of State Department. It transcends our corporate culture, our bureaucratic culture, that's devoid of empathy and honor. And it's quite disgusting. And now, didn't you? I want to wrap this up. I've kept you on for an hour and a half. I'm in Rome. I have to go get gelato. I have to go get gelato.
But before early morning there too,
But before I go get gelato, I didn't you just recently get an email where they were offering to help get you out or something? Didn't State Department email you?
Oh yeah. They actually not recently. When I was in Qatar, basically they said, hey, you have a flight on the Monday, whatever. I was like, no, I'm already here. Go call the people who left there. Like, it's too late. You know, like, why there's no coordination? It's one government. Why they should be data that sharing? We share a bit of data with so many people we have on our list. How they cannot do, like, sharing a data that this person has already evacuated?
No, and that's why we exist. That's why we exist. And Prince, you have been the greatest blessing to our work and our organization. And, you know, thanks to you and your friends and family in Afghanistan, you know, countless thousands of people survived through the winter. And so many people have made it out of Afghanistan to safety. And I look forward to working with you for the rest of my life, brother. And I'm just proud to know you. And you're a great man.
Me too, brother. Thank you. Thank you so much for everything you did for the people of Afghanistan, the people of Ukraine, and people of the world. That's what we call in. We are a citizen of this world, and we are helping anyone with any background, ethnicity, anyone that we're involved. We are Vulnerable People Project. And I'm glad to be a part of it. I'm proud to be a part of it. It's my pleasure to know you and the rest of your team for anything you do for the people of the world. That's what I call it.
I love how much you get our mission. Recently, when some wealthy, powerful person reached out to us asking for help, you called me and you said, "We're not the Rich People Project. They could figure that out on their own." And I said, "That's exactly what I've been telling these folks." I'm like, "You got it. You look, I'm sorry. My donors aren't going to help you. You figure it out on your own. You got your country and yourself into this mess. Why don't you figure your way out of it?"
We help the ones who fall and no one gets help them. So we are the ones to help them.
That's right. We're there for the vulnerable. And,
vulnerable.
And that's our mission. Well, Prince, thank you, brother. It was great spending time with you a couple weeks ago, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
I'm here, brother. Thank you, and thank you for having me in the show, and thank you to all who listened to us today.
All right. Hey, I'm going to sell pillows. Do you have MyPillow, by the way? Do you have any MyPillow products? Yeah.
Not yet.
Oh, no, I'm going to get you. It's going to be my treat. We're going to get you the whole thing. We're going to get you the MyPillow. Mike Lindell sponsors the show. We're going to get you the pillows, the mattress topper, the Giza Dream Sheets. It's going to be my gift to you because you've never slept till you. I have a Tempur-Pedic bed that my wife will not let me put the mattress topper on, but I prefer the mattress topper to my Tempur-Pedic bed. 100%.
Yeah.
So I'm going to send you. I'm going to send you all of that. All right, brother. So let me sell some pillows. Wrap up the show. You. Get some gelato. Go to Mass and hit the town. Hit Rome.
Sure, brother. Thanks so much.
All right. God bless you, Prince. Bye. All right, everyone. That is the great Prince Wafa. He runs the Vulnerable People Project ground operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's been working with us really since September, since when he was still in Afghanistan. He should have been on the show to tell you how busy we are. Prince has been doing all kinds of media, but we haven't had time to put him on the show because he is working night and day. Our entire team is working night and day, and I have wanted to have him on the show, but I've just been kicking the can down the road. He is one of the most exceptional human beings I have ever met, and I'm glad that you listened all the way to the end of the show so you kind of got to know what a great man he is. He's living the American dream. He's giving his wife a beautiful life, a beautiful home in our great country. He is, to me, the most American of Americans I've ever met. But his heroism, his discipline, his fortitude, and his organizational skills and what he's able to do for us, the Vulnerable People Project, in Afghanistan is really unbelievable. And it is unbelievable. Ambassador Brownback on a conference call recently said he had commended, of all the organizations, he said the Vulnerable People Project is moving all these people, and I just don't know how they do it. Well, the secret is Prince Wafa. We have a lot of groups that we support, and some are really good. We have team members that are really good at distributing food in remote communities. But when it comes to getting food to the most difficult places, food and coal, to rescuing people in the most dangerous of circumstances, Prince and the team that he's assembled is really unbelievable. And if you read the story about Sister Didi, Sister Deirdre Burns, who her medical team was rescued by the Vulnerable People Project, well, that was all planned and implemented and managed by Prince Wafa. So the work he is doing is absolutely unbelievable. Well, I am in Rome, but I wanted to make sure I had it. The reason I'm having Prince on today while I'm in Rome is because I want our supporters to know, the Vulnerable People Project supporters to know, I want the audience of the Jason Jones Show to know, but most importantly, I want all of those Afghans that are listening, and I know because I get messages after every show, I get messages after every email that we send and all of my social media posts. Have you forgotten about us? You know, you're talking about Ukraine, you're traveling quite a bit, and I want them to know that we are working night and day. Most of my work, most of my day-to-day activities go towards serving our work in Afghanistan. We have great teams rolling in Ukraine. We have other projects going. We're doing something on food security right now. We're getting ready to roll out. But most of my day is spent in Afghanistan, and our team in Afghanistan is relentless. For so many of you who we've rescued now, I'm talking to those of you who we've evacuated and you're in a lily pad waiting for permanent resettlement. We're not going to leave you. We're with you. We may not be as communicative with you as you would like because we're really working with folks still in Afghanistan. But we are working to find ways to get you visas. And that's part of the reason I am in Europe, is to meet with several representatives in different governments to find ways to place our people in a permanent home. That's our work. We will never quit. We will never quit. And so that's why, from Rome, we're doing this Afghanistan special with the great Prince Wafa. This episode is being brought to you by MyPillow.com. Go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, and get the great pillows, get the mattress toppers, get the Giza Dream sheets. Go to town, all right? Go to town at MyPillow.com. Use the code Jones for those deep discounts. And if you are not donating to the Vulnerable People Project, you're really not all the way on the team. By the way, this show has been the number one, it's the number one source of new donors for the Vulnerable People Project. And in fact, by God's grace, this podcast, which is something I did as ancillary, just to do because I could, has become a number one source of new donors. And it is why we have been able to support so many people and why we have never had to turn anyone down for support that has asked us for support in Afghanistan. It's why we were able to respond immediately and build a team in Ukraine. It's because of those of you who listen to the Jason Jones Show and have become donors. So thank you. So if you are a regular listener of the show and you know the work that we do, go to thegreatcampaign.org and please become a donor. And when you stand with us, your donation of any size will be put to work tomorrow, serving the most vulnerable people in the world during their most challenging times. And for us, this has been a challenging year. But by God's grace, it is our donors that really do the hard work. That you work hard and then you share with us, your wealth, that we are then able to deploy to serve the vulnerable. So we're a team, and I feel like I have the easiest part of the job. Because some of you, you're getting up every morning, you're taking the train into work for 90 minutes, you're working 10 hours a day, then you're taking the train 2 hours back, and you're supporting us. And I have to tell you that, I had the vision for the Vulnerable People Project as a young infantryman in my teens, while I was still a teenager. And I'm doing exactly what it is that I want to do, live my life between the vulnerable and the violent. And those of you who support us, you are living your life between the vulnerable and the violent too. But I don't think that you really understand that you are doing that. And I'm incredibly grateful to you. And I always tell the Afghans and the Ukrainians now that thank us, thank me. I say, you shouldn't be thanking me. Thank my donors. And then they call me and they say, tell your donors thank you. So I want to tell you thank you on behalf of, they are always telling me, the Afghan refugees that we're serving, those in Ukraine who are serving, they always do say, tell your donors thank you. And I don't think I tell you. So they're telling you thank you. I'm telling you thank you. And if you're not a donor yet, go to thegreatcampaign.org and please become a donor and share this episode. I never ask people to share an episode, but Prince Wafa is a great American hero. I think he's going to run for office. I think he's going to be a congressman one day, maybe senator, governor. He is just one of the most impressive people I have ever met. And I've been around a lot of very impressive people. I've been blessed in my life. Known Tulsi Gabbard since she was 12, Justin Bieber, who is an incredibly entertaining young man. His mother's a dear friend of mine. I met Justin Bieber. I've met two popes. I'm gonna meet a third pope tomorrow. And I met presidents. I've met a lot of I've hung out with Dave Chappelle. You're going to see me in the Chappelle Show special coming out this summer. I've been around a lot of very bright, talented, exceptional people. But Prince Wafa is really at the top of that list. So share this episode because I want as many people as possible to meet the great American hero, Prince Wafa. All right. I'm heading out. Going to go to Mass, get some gelato, do some work. And we'll have some interesting shows, I hope, coming to you over the next couple of days as I travel from Rome to Poland and to places beyond. So stay tuned. It's the Jason Jones Show.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.